Hello and welcome to the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann, a listener-supported program. My guest for this episode is Larry Santoyo, a permaculture designer and teacher currently located in California. He's been a member of the community for some time, and I enjoyed the conversation I had with him. He had me laughing hard quite a few times, though I removed them so you could hear him talking and not my guffawing in the background. His delivery and manner is easygoing, and even though he said he doesn't like sound bites, is incredibly quotable. In this conversation, we talk about Bill Mollison, the misrepresentation of permaculture, applying the permaculture concepts broadly, and how we can arrive at solutions. Though his website is under construction, you can find his contact information on it at earthflow.com. He also teaches with the City of Angels Permaculture Academy. Find out more about that program at cityofangelspermaculture.com. If you enjoyed this or any other episodes of the show, please consider lending a hand to help me continue to get this information out there and, in turn, to build a better world. Find out how at thepermaculturepodcast.com/support. Now then, on to Larry Santoyo. I'll join you afterwards with some thoughts and updates.
Then, Larry, if you're ready, could you give us a little bit of your biography and background and we can take it from there?
My name's Larry Santoyo. That part is true. I was involved in permaculture, I guess, early on in the States anyway. I know that it had been going on a lot overseas, but I got involved kind of early on in the permaculture world when it hit the States. And it was kind of by happenstance. I was, many years earlier, a friend of mine had told me that he had been to New Zealand, and I was kind of intrigued just about that. Growing up in Southern California, I guess there's a lot of other cool places in the world. And we had a conversation that he heard somebody on the radio, and it turned out to be Bill Mollison. And at the time, he was describing Bill Mollison as kind of a curmudgeon, which I later found out he was accurate. But he was telling me that Bill Mollison was saying on the radio that he thinks that we could design better than nature. And that just kind of stuck with me as like, how arrogant, how, you know, it's like, leave it to academia to talk like that, you know? And then I just kind of put it in the back of my mind for years and years and years. Well, it turns out that I read an article, and it would have had to been in some weird little newsletter because it's way before emails and websites and all that, that there was going to be a conference. And one of the people that was speaking at the conference was Bill Mollison. So I went up and met him. It got introduced for the first time to that whole world of permaculture. I was actually working in California. I worked for the state of California. And I ended up getting injured on duty. And part of my settlement, I guess, was that I got vocational rehabilitation, and I tested for high in land use planning and conservation and those kinds of things. So they sent me to planning schools, and we did a little bit of planning for the state park system. I had been working for the state parks for a short while before that, and then they asked that you specialize in something, and I wanted to specialize in resource management. So I put in training requests, and I wrote them as resource management courses. And what they were permaculture design courses with Bill Mollison. And they approved them, and that was I was launched then. I never looked back. Bill Mollison, a few years later, encouraged me to teach. I followed him around for many years. We were good friends. I taught with them in Australia and in the States in the early 90s. I guess the late 80s and the early 90s was when I got involved.
As one of the later additions to the world of permaculture, myself and many others always have a lot of questions about Bill because as he's taught less and less and not having access to him, and your curmudgeon response seems to be the general first impression. That he likes to kind of push people's buttons and set them on fire to really get them to analyze the place that they're from. But those are only the stories that I hear. Could you speak a little bit about what it was like training with Bill and working with him for those years?
I have a great deal of respect for Bill. I mean, we were good friends for a long time. And, you know, I babysat his kids. I'm in his autobiography. I traveled a lot with him, not as much as a lot of people out there, but we were pretty good friends. We had a good time. I helped him with the, I don't know if you've ever seen the videos, but the Global Gardener. It's like a series of videos that were made after, which I thought was a great film. I even watched it recently, was In Grave Danger of Falling Food, and it seemed like it would be dated, but it's not. Just like his book, it's just like, it's kind of timeless. But I was a PA, a production assistant on those films. And it was kind of interesting, you know, just watching Bill. And I learned probably the most about Bill's ability to read the landscape. Was outstanding. It was almost scary how he could, you know, we would land somewhere and he would just be able to decipher what was going on and see what was happening around. And to me, it was like magic. It was like watching a shaman at work. I guess Bill was, I think, you know, went out of his way to be kind of an asshole at times, so people like me wouldn't want to hang out with him all the time, you know, because, I mean, the guy must have been just mobbed all the time, and certainly we were treated either really well or really poorly when we traveled places. Bill definitely left his mark on a lot of places and probably a lot of people.
That kind of bigger-than-life status and personality to go with it.
Yeah, I mean, there's no rock star manual. I mean, I wouldn't blame him or, you know, I mean, how would you act if everybody was doing that to you? You know, it was just weird because of all the things I saw, I think that he really could have done more with his kind of status and fame. He could have been a millionaire. He could have been, you know, all these things. But he was pretty, you could say whatever you want and most of it will be true about him. But I always thought that his integrity, his commitment to, you know, his original plan was always there. And it's still probably, always, you know, still with him.
That underneath all of that, it was really about sharing this information and using it to build a better world?
I don't know that Bill would say that. I think that I have said that when I've been drinking. I don't think it's that romantic, but I think that it got there. I think that despite what he did, despite what a lot of us did, it's getting there. It is making a difference in the world. And whether people have heard of it or not, I really personally don't give a shit about that. But it's just that it's employed places.
From that, do you mean that people are using this information and actually building working models and continuing to experiment with it and try new things?
Yeah, I think that that's always happened. And it's kind of the nature of the way that Bill taught. He kind of left it in this kind of vague place where you quickly realize that that's what it's about. It's about making it work. It's about watching something, applying principles, and then observing it itself. So it's like a fractal model of the teaching itself. Every project becomes a new illustration of permaculture design. I have to interrupt and say that if there's anything that I want to say about permaculture design is that it is grossly misrepresented in the States and, you know, abroad. And I think that a lot of it is a disservice, but a lot of it is good. You know, there's kind of like no bad press, the saying of no bad press, which I'm not sure I believe. That my impression and what I teach is that you don't do permaculture. It's not something that you do. You don't do permaculture. You use permaculture in what you do. You sort of apply it to the world of economics. You apply it, of course, the sexiest and most popular application of permaculture design is in gardening or agriculture, those kinds of things. But it can be applied to anything. It's systems design. It's systems thinking. I describe permaculture design, or I define permaculture design as protocols for problem solving and decision making. You know, it's critical thinking based on observation of natural patterns.
What you said there echoes something, and I'm paraphrasing from the best of my memory because my children are slowly stealing my sanity and ability to think.
Yeah, my kids did that long ago.
A friend of mine jokes that insanity is hereditary. We get it from our children. But anyway, I spoke with David Holmgren, and near the end of that conversation, he said that permaculture should be applied, that each of us kind of have a niche to fill, and that we can apply permaculture wherever we are, that it doesn't have to be just landscape design, that it can be anything. Is that kind of how you feel?
Yeah, of course, of course. You know, I'm glad that you told me that he says that, because, you know, I think that it's really grossly misrepresented all around the world, mostly by us, mostly by ourselves, because most of us got into it through agriculture and landscaping and those kinds of things. But a lot of us have been breaking away and trying to apply it. And my courses are packed with, of course, we talk about natural systems, but as a metaphor, we talk about the garden and get it pretty intensive in the garden, but as a metaphor for everything else, about building community and about economics and business. And all of my course projects have to have a business component to it. And I've been teaching for 20 years, so it's like I've got thousands of students out there that I feel are applying permaculture to what they do. And I tell them, you know, like Bill Mollison told us, you know, don't even talk about it. Don't even call it permaculture. Only if you must. It's like, just let people ask you about the project itself, not to try to define permaculture, which is a whole funny conversation in itself. And we've tried to make videos about it, and it's pretty hilarious the way people describe it.
How people describe it, because of all the different definitions you get and the different viewpoints on what permaculture is and is not?
And just the kind of, you know, euphemisms that people want to come up with. You know, it's like everybody's dying for a soundbite. It's like, I don't understand that. Although people say that I'm the soundbite king, it's like, I don't want it to be trivialized to a soundbite. It's like my life's work. I was upset with somebody that was interviewing me on the radio one time. It's like, would you describe to us, you know, in 30 seconds what, you know, this is all about? It's like, why would you trivialize my life's work into a 30-second soundbite, you know? And then it's like, cool. Actually, that would be a good idea if I had a 30-second soundbite. That's when I came up with that decision-making and problem-solving protocols.
I think about it, you know, how would you describe permaculture as an elevator pitch? You know, you've got 3 floors to tell somebody what this is.
I'd get off at the next floor. I'd change the subject. I'd get the hell out of that elevator, because I wouldn't want to try to describe it like that. And I think that it's a trap. You've caught yourself already as to something went wrong if somebody asks you that question. You know, it's like you should be talking about the economic development strategies that you've developed, or about the food program, or the, you know, whatever it is that you're doing with permaculture, instead of saying, I do permaculture. That's just ridiculous.
Do you think that that's something that we need to overcome within the community in order to communicate these ideas better?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Maybe I'm not being clear here. It's like, absolutely. Don't talk about it, because you're fucking it up for a lot of people. It's like, people, it's like, oh, there's that guy, there's that sketchy guy talking about permaculture. And then you ask him, it's like, oh, you know, the balance and the, you know, the yin and the yang and the up and the down. It's like, what the hell is he talking about? If you just talk about, like I said, this food program, or this lawn conversion, or this economic development, or co-office, you know, working space, or, you know, this co-industrial space, or, you know, it's like, talk about the damn project. Quit trying to define what permaculture is, because you'll never get there. I define permaculture in my classes with an illustration. You know, I draw it on the board through a series of questions and answers, and then I tell people, look at what we just drew on the board. When people ask you what permaculture is, draw them this. That's the answer. You know, I don't think it should be defined as, you know, whatever people try to define it, especially gardening. It's like, my God, it's not gardening. Gardening is a beautiful and brilliant metaphor for what we're doing, but permaculture has nothing to do with it. A brilliant exercise, a brilliant application, but certainly not about gardening.
Is that a place that you've come to in the last 20 plus years of doing this work, or this perspective is something you've carried with you from those early days.
I think that if you listen to Bill Mollison 30 years ago, he said the same thing. It's just that, like myself, like all the other teachers, after saying that, we go on to talk about fucking gardening. It's like, you know, most of us came through it, you know, some of us came through illegal gardening or whatever, you know. It's like a lot of us have that kind of knowledge. So I happen to be a planner, urban planner and ecologist, systems ecologist. So, you know, it's easy to make different leaps using different mediums. It's like being an artist where you're not just a sculptor, you're also a photographer, you're also a, you know, that's what permaculture is. You use the same principles with a different medium. I'm going to use the same principles. That's how my courses work. That's how I operate my classes. You know, I ask people, what does it take to create a sustainable world? Or what do you want in your community? Or some way to engage people to like yell out, oh, we need food, we need water, we need shelter, we need energy, we need some kind of trade system, we need some kind of, people always want to have rules or something, although they sit there and say they're anti-rules. I think they just really want to weave in punishment or something in there. You know, so we make this whole list and I draw it as a wheel. It's that image that I was just trying to describe earlier. You know, I draw it as a wheel of infrastructure and it ends up as being infrastructure and invisible structures like we talk about in permaculture, sort of the softer skills that are as important, as required, as maybe even more important, you know, than some of those other things. You know, the economics, the access to land, the community, the communication, the agreements, all of those legal structures that we need and we've avoided for decades. As it turns out, it's really what we need to know. We need to know about those things. So I ask people to describe that, and then I look at it and have everybody step back. I draw it as a wheel, and you know, I have everybody look at it and I said, okay, we have just defined what permaculture design is. You know, it's like, we're going to use these principles and I launch into, you know, my synthesized version of it. Everybody's got a kind of a different version, it turns out, because Bill never wrote 12 principles or 10 principles or whatever. I've synthesized it to indicators of sustainability, which are just, you know, stuff I've pulled out of Bill's lectures. And you know, it's like, we're going to use these indicators of sustainability and we're going to go and we're going to touch every single thing that you yelled out that we need to have a sustainable human settlement. We're going to use these indicators of sustainability. We're going to use these permaculture design principles and we're going to apply it to transportation. We're going to apply it to shelter. We're going to apply it to communication. We're going to apply it to, oh, where's food? Where's gardening? Oh, it's one of the 12, 15, 25 pieces, one of the pieces that we're going to apply it to. We need to apply it to everything as importantly, with as much emphasis and with as much focus, with as much passion and with as much enthusiasm that you could instill on your students, because it's all important. There's no skill that we cannot use to get through this. We need everybody. Gardening is not the weak link of a sustainable future. Food is not the weak link of a sustainable future. I mean, come on. You know, how are we going to put out a fire? You know, how are we going to rescue somebody in a swift water situation? How are we going to, you know, it's like if they pull the plug, if the plug gets pulled like everybody wants or everybody's, I don't know what the deal is about the world ending. Ask me about that in a second. There's other stuff to worry about. Food is not one of them. Try to make your zucchini stop. I come from a long line of migrant farm workers and, you know, gardening and all that, it's like lost its romanticism for me. It's like, let's get serious. Growing food, not to trivialize the ancient craft or anything, but it's like, it's not that hard.
You're more concerned about the broader structures that people haven't considered?
We live in a broad structure. Of course I'm concerned with that. Yes, yes. We all live in a broad structure. We all, you know, participate in this community, even though, you know, we don't live on the same piece of land or, you know, dress the same or whatever. But that's another part of the story. The guise, the image, the imagery that we create in our movements about celebrating diversity, yet everybody in all of those meetings are exactly the same. if somebody had a different set of politics, then they would be shunned just like in any other group out there. It's crazy. I go to my friends' meetings and, you know, get invited to all this stuff, and everybody wants you to be a fucking vegan or a fucking, you know, it's like, oh, you're not a vegetarian, you smoke, you drink, you use bad words. It's like, fuck, no, I don't do any of that stuff. You know, I'm eating a cheeseburger or something. People have their whole, you know, and it's at a meeting to celebrate diversity. You know, like, it's crazy. It's crazy. And then that gets back to my whole thing about, you know, then it's those people that want to talk and, you know, tell people permaculture. It's like, leave people alone. They're, you know, you got to arrive at it. You don't get religion at the airport anymore. You don't learn stuff because somebody, you know, excuse me, sir, have you heard the word of permaculture today? Sir, and the people start running from you. It's ridiculous. Leave people alone. Leave your dad alone. Leave your brother alone. Leave your neighbor alone. Just do your work, and that should be its own reward. You know, I want people to come over and ask you what you're doing. Ask you what you're doing. Then they'll be interested. Then tell them. Don't knock on their door. Bill Mollison used to tell us, never knock on closed doors. And it's like, I took it to heart. Everywhere I go, there's a crowd of people that want to know. It's like, we couldn't get through each person in this room, much less start knocking on closed doors. I mean, it's like, there's not enough time. It's ridiculous.
You speak to one of the places that I came from when I was first going through all this, was that I want to go out and I want to set the world on fire. I want to evangelize this and get it to everybody, you know? And then I realize it's like, no, I can't do that.
Everybody went out and, you know, like, save the swales. It's like everybody dug a swale and built the, you know, the obligatory herb spiral and all that. It's like, stop. That's ridiculous. You know, it's like, come on. Or a cob bench or something, you know? It's like, come on. Nobody wants to sit on mud.
It was Dave Jackie who was talking about how each era has its own fads, that, you know, the 80s seemed to be the herb spiral, and now it's Hugel culture beds and all these other things.
Yeah, it's the same thing. It's like people are imposing it, right? It's like the Hugel culture. Somebody was saying that, oh, well, you know, I heard this is a good technique, and I heard this is a, you know, blah, blah, blah. It's like, yeah, if you live at the edge of a forest that you just cut and you've got a bulldozer and you're rolling stuff and debris over to the edge, yeah, plant that. But, you know, people are like asking me what the best stuff to buy to bring to their property is to do Hugel culture. It's like, oh my God. People that carving swales when you don't have a runoff issue. You know, it's like, you don't just do it. You arrive at solutions. You don't impose solutions. Then it's not a solution. I tell this story all the time about, you know, I took a fascinating course in the Southwest with Max Merriman, who was like reintroducing this whole thing about straw bale construction, right? Straw bale houses, you know, the first little pig was right, you know, kind of thing. And I was fascinated with it because I loved, you know, the thick wall adobe look. And then I realized that, you know, you could make it look like anything. It could look like, you know, Frank Lloyd Wright built it, or Neutra built it, or, you know, it's a material that you're free to do, you know, what you want with and finish it how you want. Sure, it could look like a hippie hovel, but it doesn't have to. It could look like anything. I was fascinated with the medium. I built a small house for a friend, and somebody wrote an article about it. Somebody read the article. I get a phone call from people in Hawaii. Oh, you know, I read this article, and, you know, and I want you to come and build us a straw bale house. It's like, okay, I would love to build you a house. I'm not sure it's going to be straw. It's like, oh, well, I really want a straw house because, you know, it says right here in Eco Hipster magazine or whatever the fuck. It's eco hip to have a straw bale house or whatever the fad of the day is, right? It's kind of the same. I tell this story in class and I say, why did I tell them that, you know, straw bales would be appropriate technology in Hawaii? And of course, everybody talks about, oh, it rains too much. Oh, they don't grow straw. Oh, they, you know, it's too humid. Oh, this, that, all these other things. And of course, there's a defense of straw with every one of those things. Of course, there's buildings in Alabama where, you know, the you know, humidity never gets, I don't know. Have you ever been to Alabama? It's like 100% humidity, 365 days a year. I don't know. It's like, no, and there's perfectly intact you know, buildings there. And snowdrifts in Nebraska, you know, 12 feet against straw bale houses that are 100 years old. And 50-year-old houses in the Skagit Valley where they get 100 inches of rain. So it'll test all of those things. And people are going, well, why is it inappropriate? It's like we arrive at solutions. We arrive at a medium because of its properties. We look at the outside influencing energies, right? Permaculture design, sector planning. Right. I also say sectors trump everything. Sectors beat two of a kind. Sectors beat everything. Sectors certainly beat Eco-Hipster magazine. You arrive at straw bales as the medium to use when you have extreme temperatures high and or low, right? Because you're arriving at a material that will give you super insulation. You have gone through the protocols of design and you have arrived that you need super insulation to make this work, right? Not the case in Hawaii. Hawaii is, you know, high of 72, low of 72. It's not like you need R50 walls, right? You don't need that super insulation. What you need is ventilation strategies. You need, you know, other things than that. That, to me, is imposing a solution on a landscape instead of arriving at a solution on a landscape.
A large portion of the conversation that I recently had with Bob Tice, because I was following up with him on questions of different building materials, and many of them he wouldn't speak to because his expertise is really in straw bale construction and earth plasters, but then talked about some of those similar issues of needing to find something that's appropriate for where you are, not trying to make something work, but to work with what you have.
And Bob Tice has got some beautiful and elegant buildings that he's worked on. And you know, he was up there in the Bay Area over in Berkeley working with Kelly, and they came up with that vaulted thing that was just incredible. You know, just beautiful stuff. And then on that same note, it's like to be a master, to be a craftsman, to be, you know, world-renowned on a particular medium, and then arrive at, this might not be appropriate everywhere. That says something. That is a big, you know, signal to people and a testament to Bob Tice's actual ability to read the landscape, actual ability to, you know, do the best thing for the landscape. And, you know, Yontel Evans, surprisingly, the chapter in his hand-sculpted house book is incredible. It's an incredible story of that Cobb, who this man lives and dies. I mean, he's shaped like he's, you know, building Cobb, even when he's just standing there. It's like, this guy is Cobb, you know, and in his chapter on site planning, he talks about, which is a great chapter, and I always refer to it for people to, you know, read the patterns of the landscape. That's one of the better ones. But he talks about, finally says out loud, you know, that Cobb's not always appropriate. You know, it's just like, you gotta love it when people have spent their life on something. And of course, you know, you go to these fucking green builders or these, you know, like greenwash companies, and you know, they have a one size fits all for everything, and you know, you're not hip unless you do what our stuff is, and you know, and that's just not the case. You arrive at solutions because of the outside influencing energies that affect the site. Dynamic stability. Bill Mollison taught us that. You don't impose a static solution on a dynamic problem.
Thank you so much for that. I feel like I've been banging my head against the wall.
Yeah, well, stop. And stop if you're wearing a permaculture t-shirt. Bang your head on the wall wearing something else.
It's from the place that I come from, because I kind of arrived at this niche when I realized where my abilities are, having a conversation with a bunch of people and realizing, wait, I have a background in IT and communications. I can leverage my skills to do what I'm doing now, this conversation, like all the tech that I have sitting in front of me. And it's that whole, well, let's impose something in the same place. And I've been trying to overcome that in conversations to provide we need to think about this. No, but I love this. This is what I want to do. No, that's a technique. Let's go to the ethics. Let's work from the ethics to the principles. Anyway.
It's true, you know, and to be reminded about that, you know, I can go off on somebody else, but then when I sit and examine my own business or my own life, or, you know, it's like, now, wait a second, you know, but Of course, that's why you have children. I have adult children that pointed out for me now. It's like, Dad, have you ever heard of a design system called permaculture? I was like, you're putting the cart before the horse. You know, you're talking about the details when you need to be talking about the bigger pattern. You come to that, and finding a niche just like that is pretty important. I would love to know all that IT stuff, especially these days. I mean, the world changed since we started doing this. Nobody thought about bandwidth. Nobody thought about how we would optimize our search engine capability. Nobody thought about that. But I'm glad people are doing it. You know, it's like, of course, I wish they were doing it for me.
Well, the nice thing is that I'm doing all that with the work that I do. So in a way, I'm kind of optimizing what will go on my website to point back to what you're doing so people can find both of us as a result.
That's kind of like permaculture design. Have you ever heard of that? Where you stack things?
For my question earlier, I try to approach every interview as if I don't know anything about what we're talking about so that for anybody who tunes in, if it's their first episode, they can get both a fresh approach and then what I wrap around it is a little more structured. But it's what you said earlier about trying to kind of impose yourself on people. One of the best pieces I've gotten from anyone who I've spoken to was the idea of meeting someone where they're at. Like, that was the easiest way to kind of get a soundbite about it, but that it's not about where you're coming from, but where they're coming from.
I mean, if the objective is to make a point, is get a point across, but that might be imposed too. It's like, unless they asked for it, it's really not an objective.
The example that I'm thinking about is like a friend of mine who wants a simple garden that can include bees, because they really want to raise bees for honey and some other things that I can design a very basic garden that meets
not a vegan, I guess.
No.
Eating honey exploits insects, apparently. I'm in LA, I get it all. Yeah.
Just for me, for her, it's, you know, I can do a strawberry border for her, do some perennials that the bees will visit and make them happy, and some other basic things, and integrate it in a way that for me I feel is a comfortable permaculture based design that she doesn't need to know everything that's behind the scenes.
Oh yeah, sure.
You know, that meets her needs, what she wants, without going over the top. But that looks very different from someone who's trying to do like a 1-acre nature-mimicked food forest. And are they both permaculture? Well, some people would say that they are, some people would say that they aren't. And I guess at the end of the day, I don't have to care because I'm meeting my friend's needs for a design.
Exactly. Along that route, you know, it's like you're obviously trying to do your friend a favor. It's like, if she was that interested, she would ask, or, you know, certainly you could make that information available. And I'm sure you're not like cutting her short or whatever. I'm sure she would get it or whatever. She just maybe doesn't need to know all that stuff or want to know all that stuff. And you're doing it with her, for her, you know, without bombarding her with the information. I'd throw in some, you know, keep going with rosacea on that, by the way. I'd have, you know, perennial hedges of raspberries and blackberries and, you know, not just strawberries, because the raspberries and stuff will flower a lot longer and have, you know, house other insects too.
Anyway, that's just a side point from some of the places that I've gone through in, yeah, I guess just trying to break that cycle of technique. No, we need to step back and look at some other things.
Yeah, because, I mean, the techniques and technologies are kind of the interesting parts of things, but it's certainly not, you can't really say it's a permaculture technique. People want to do that, but it's a technique, period. You know, maybe some of the ways that you arrived at that would be permaculture, but, you know, certainly sheep mulching, you know, maybe, who knows where it came from, there's all kinds of whatever, but it doesn't matter. The idea that we're teaching is that we are trying to mimic the forest floor. Create a light barrier, create a mulch barrier, you know, a layer, create a nutrient layer, create, and then stack it with diversity, you know, a guild. Everybody wants to read a book like, oh, what is a guild? What is any guild? Well, a guild is components that could be thousands of pieces, each one of them. A nitrogen fixer, you know, depending on where you are, there's a pallet of a dozen plants that it could be. But people want to know, like, these little plants and, you know, you give people specific details about things and then they forget to think out of it. If something changes, they won't be able to like those cows that you see that, you know, the water hole dries up and they just don't have the skill set to like go look over the other hill to see if there's more water over there. Like the water, the water is right here and now it's not, it's like, come on, you got to be able to think. That's the brilliance of the permaculture design course curriculum, is that it doesn't hand you the answers. It teaches you how to think about solving issues. You know, and people that want to take notes and do a cookie cutter thing, you know, whoever said that, and I was credited with the saying one time, and begrudgingly, I admitted that I didn't come up with it, that there's a lot of tools in the permaculture toolbox, but a cookie cutter is not one of them. I can think of dozens of places that are very near each other, and there are a dozen different places. Totally different designs because of the people that were there or the particular soil in that spot or the particular aspect or drainage or whatever. You know, you arrive at solutions, you know, just cookie cutter, you know, some green building or some, I don't give a shit if it's LEED platinum, it hit these marks or whatever. It's in the wrong spot, you know, whatever that is. It's reading the patterns of the landscape and arriving at solutions.
Which touches on, if you will, like that mantra that every site is unique or that every space is different. So we have to really apply these different pieces in order to figure out what the actual solutions are going to be. We can't just...
Yeah, and the point is that, you know, and Bill Mollison, you know, he used to say it is that he may even know the answer, but he's not necessarily just going to hand you the answer because he wants you to learn how to problem solve. And I feel that permaculture design is a lot like that because people come into the courses and they say, oh, it's not hands-on enough. Well, it's not hands-on enough because I don't trust you yet. I don't want to give you a shovel. I don't want to give you a bulldozer yet. I want to know that you know the theory behind, you know, recreating or mimicking a forest floor. That's what we're trying to do. That's what we're trying to get. How you do it, you know, maybe there's a technique and a technology that I don't even know about how to do that. But if the outcome is the same, the theory behind it is so important. And a lot of people forget about that. You could take a class in building with stone or building with earth or building with, you know, but it still doesn't teach you where to put it in the landscape and when to use a technique and when to use a technology. You know, using a scythe is good. Building with mud is good. Building with straw is good. But where you place the building is as important, maybe even more important. I've argued with people, you know, like architects that I've built a few, what I think are pretty nice designs. And of course, a lot of the designs and ideas are stolen from time-tested, mother-approved buildings and techniques from around the world. But, you know, people are saying, oh, well, I've been in this magazine and I've been in that magazine. It's like, yeah, that might be true and that's an awesome building, but it's in the wrong spot. You know, you put it in the cold drain. You put it in the wind tunnel. You put it, you know, it's like putting solar panels in a venturi between canyons. You know, it's like you're just going to make a scatter pattern of little pieces of solar panels.
One of the things that you touched on earlier as we step back and think about really how to design and not focus on technique was about the end of the world and like civilization falling apart. And for me, I don't want that to happen. I kind of like some of the things that we have, but could you speak to your thoughts on that?
Sure. I could speak to my thoughts on it. Of course, I don't know what the answer is. I know what the commonality in all those end of the world sort of scenarios. And the commonality is that the world isn't ended. The world hasn't ended. You know, it's like, I don't know what people's fascination or, you know, obsession with the world, wanting the world to end. Maybe it's because then they don't have to be responsible for anything or take responsibility or, you know, do some of the stuff that might be hard. I don't know. It's like ever since man could put a sign on a stick, the world has been ending. I don't get it. I don't really get it. You know, it's like we all live through the Y2K stuff, and, you know, it's like 1,000 articles there must have been about how the world was going to end and, you know, there was going to be chaos. And as much as I would love that kind of, you know, road warrior kind of scenario to happen, you know, it just isn't going to. It didn't. You know, maybe it was like by whatever that happened, but it didn't happen. But not one article after that about how gullible we are about that kind of shit. I never read anything about how we always want to fall for that. You know, it's like it's time that we realize that the world is not going to end. You know, even if it does, we'll, you know, we'll go out swinging. There's a war in the Pleiades. Did you know that? You know, there's another one. It's like everybody's worried about something all the time. Are we making it up? I don't know. But it's like selling fear works because people are there to buy it. The world is going to end, or peak oil, or peak toil, or peak soil, or whatever it happens to be. You know, that you're using up too much. Is your carbon footprint, you know, okay, people want you to feel bad about your life. Fuck the carbon footprint. You know, it's like use the carbon that you're using to, and do good things. Go out there and do things. You know, use your car to take orphans to the farmer's market, or, you know, deliver organic produce. I don't know. It's like just make sure that your handprint is bigger than your footprint. Make it an impression on the world and do good things that, you know, to help people and bring that community around. People want to act like things are going to be so bad. It's like, well, we stay on top of it. You know, we still need to get water to our garden. We could collect water. We could do gravity water systems, Y2K compliant, by the way. It's still a good idea. Even if the world doesn't end, you know, it's still a good idea to do these things. That's the important part, that get your community to commit to becoming more of a conserver society. Help that along by doing things. Learn how to do things. Learn how to do things. That's going to help people getting out there. And it's like everybody should learn how to cuss in several languages, you know, and like work hard and, you know, get through the day, and we get along better at the end of that day. You should be out there, you know, working hard and discussing things that you're doing, not speculating endlessly about things that might happen. What about embracing sustainability, you know, because we love the things we love about the present, not because we fear the future?
I really like that. And we could close the interview on that, but I always like to leave an opportunity for last words. Do you have any last thoughts that you'd like to share with the listeners?
I guess that really would be my last words, that let's not embrace sustainability because we fear the future. Let's embrace sustainability because we love the things we love about now.
Well, Larry, thank you for all the things that you've shared with us.
Absolutely.
The hope and inspiration in those last thoughts. I really appreciate that, and I look forward to sharing it with the world.
Thanks for having me.
And that was Larry Santoyo. As you heard, I did enjoy this conversation, and also that note that we ended on, that simple question, what about embracing sustainability because we love the things we love about the present, not because we fear the future? And I'm just going to leave you with that to take out into the world. You'll also find some of my favorite quotes from this episode in the show notes. After hearing this conversation with Larry, what are your thoughts on permaculture, how to communicate these ideas, and what we can do next? As always, I'd love to hear from you. show@thepermaculturepodcast.com or by phone, 717-827-6266. You can also follow me on Twitter, where I am @permaculturecst. Or join in the conversation by liking the show on Facebook, facebook.com/thepermaculturepodcast. Up next week is Damian McEnany, and we talk about trees and also practicing permaculture. After that is Dr. Dennis Van Engelsdorp. He's one of the scientists researching colony collapse disorder and the honeybee die-off. Dennis shares the latest information on these issues with us. Also, if anyone's interested, I've been contacted by someone who lives just outside of Utica, New York, who's interested in renting a portion of a farm property they recently purchased to someone with permaculture experience. They'd like that individual, or some individuals, or a family, to move to the site and develop some of the land with a long-term perennial permaculture vision. The space includes a 3-bedroom farmhouse and several outbuildings. If you'd like more information, please contact me and I can send that to you. I'll also be releasing a general update episode in a few weeks that covers a lot of behind-the-scenes information regarding the podcast memberships, including the offers and values becoming part of that, some changes that will be happening with the website in coming months, including a server migration, the online PDCs to be offered next year, and more on this rental opportunity in New York. That about covers everything for the moment, at least that I can think of. I'll talk to you again soon. Until the next time, take care of the earth, yourself, and each other. And the legal. The Permaculture Podcast is released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives license. Feel free to share it. Just let people know where you got it from, and don't change or sell it.